From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is the perfect time of year to sink your teeth into a peach. Georgia's state fruit is now in season, and it will still be sweet and juicy all through the end of the summer. Today we'll talk about all kinds of Georgia-grown products, from peaches to ginger to grass-fed beef. We whet our appetite for today's show with yesterday's conversation about whether cornbread should be sweet or not. Rapper Killer Mike helped kick things off.
The answer is Georgia prefers sugar in their cornbread. If you get Georgia and go toward even some parts of the Carolinas, but Alabama, parts of Tennessee prefer it starchy. My grandmother's from Alabama. My grandfather's from Georgia.
So you had both.
Yeah, so his family would put, like, my grandmas that are from Georgia and my great-grandmas and aunts would sprinkle a little sugar in their cornbread, and the ones from Alabama didn't, so it's a bitter taste. It tastes like corn. It's a bitter. Well, it's not sweet corn. It's like a starchier taste. I prefer the starchier one.
And we put the question out to you on Twitter. At last check of our poll, sweet was winning, and savory was a few percentage points behind. Here are your first thoughts. Jean Cahill from Rome grew up on a farm in South Georgia.
In my kitchen, desserts are sweet, cornbread, and savory. I can make a meal on the kind of cornbread I make because it has chopped onion, bell peppers, a little olive oil instead of Crisco or other shortening. And it is baked thin so it gets crispy on top and bottom.
Jean says she makes her special cornbread in a black iron skillet that's been in her family for generations. And I bet it's delicious, Jean. You can drop it by the studio anytime. We always want to know what you think. And you can call us at 404-500-9457. You can reach us on Twitter at OST Talk or post to Facebook. And we might feature your comments on the show. Agriculture is the most lucrative industry in Georgia. Our farms contribute about $75.5 billion to the state's economy. Now the state wants to allow farmers to contribute to the marketing of their food. Commissioner of Agriculture Gary Black has revitalized a state program known as Georgia Grown, and Gary Black joins us now to talk a little bit more about this brand. Good morning.
Boy, it's a pleasure to be here, and what a great day in Georgia.
I guess it would always be a great day in Georgia, right?
It must
when,
be.
When is
if
a day when
Georgia
you say this
day,
is an awful day in Georgia?
Yeah, if it's a Georgia Grown Day, it's a great day. And
okay.
That's what we're glad to get to visit with your listeners today.
Fair enough. Also with us is a member of Georgia Grown, Ross Harding. We welcome him back. He's the co-founder and CEO of Verdant Kitchen. Hi, Ross.
Hey, it's nice to be back.
Because last time we were talking about how popular ginger was, Georgia ginger was with Oprah.
We were. It was in the last quarter of last year when two of our products, both with the Georgia Grown logo on them, were chosen by Oprah for her favorite things.
So that's marketing that you did not have to do or pay for. That's what Oprah did.
Well, we certainly had to do it.
Yeah.
That's
well,
for sure.
I mean, you didn't have to construct the marketing campaign.
We did not.
But I reason I mention it is because the last time we talked, you assured me you were going to have more than enough product to meet all the orders, and I just wanted to check back with you.
There were days where warm product was being shipped straight from the factory, but we did not have one day that we ran out. And I know I challenged your listeners, see if you can make us run out. And
yeah,
let me tell you, they did their level best and bless them all.
So Gary, what is different about this Georgia Grown campaign than the Georgia Grown campaign original?
Well, and I think it's just important to move forward. It's we really want to focus on economic development and look at this largest sector of our economy, and that's agriculture. So we felt like there was a role for the Department of Agriculture to play there. When we look at local markets, the enthusiasm there is a statewide, nationwide about, you know, buying from local people, buying from local businesses, doing business with local farmers, consuming local product. This is very strong in the marketplace. So we felt like it was really important to brand Georgia-produced products in a way that would be exciting to the consumer, and that's what we've done.
So, but what does local mean to you? Because there's no official definition of local, and I read this study where they found that for consumers, when they asked them to define local, they defined it in terms of driving distance.
Yeah, and I don't think that debate, I don't know, is one that's worthy today, because when we're talking about Georgia Grown, we're talking about Georgia businesses that are employing people in the forestry business and the food business and agriculture and those services that actually, you know, help support that industry. And that's what this has all been about. Not necessarily the purity of product, But we're putting Georgia businesses together to do business with each other, and that's going to put a real brand on Georgia produced products. And that's what Georgia Grown is all about. And so we're really excited for the Department of Agriculture to actually be at the table, to be able to have this interaction with Georgia consumers, and then brand that Georgia product to be shipped domestically and all around the world. And we're seeing great enthusiasm in this arena.
Ross, where do you sell most of your product? Is it here in Georgia or is it around the country and the world?
It was certainly as the business started, it was primarily in Georgia, although now we sell as much product outside of Georgia as we do inside Georgia. In fact, I think our number two state now is California, where we sell our product.
What's the value then of that sticker that says Georgia Grown?
It's very important. You know, I think there's a strong movement for people wanting to understand where their food comes from. And, you know, whether this is a terminology of local or exactly what that means, for each individual person, they want to know what's the provenance of this product. You know, where did it come from? And these are people who, by and large, they're interested in what they're eating. They're perhaps suspicious sometimes of what they're eating. And I think that the Georgia Grown brand gives them some certainty to at least know, okay, I know geographically that these were products produced in a known location, which is known as a supremely high-quality food producer. And so I think this is probably the most important, at least for us, aspect that logo has.
Do you see the Georgia Grown label as sort of tapping into the farm-to-table movement that we've seen?
There's no doubt about it. That's just where we've got a great opportunity to build the relationship between people and the food they consume. And that's another key tenet of the program. We see whether it's in a local farmer's market or working with our partners of the Georgia Restaurant Association. By the way, we're about to have our second James Beard dinner in New York with the Georgia Grown to take New York by storm again. But we're working with chefs, working in our school systems. Our Feed My School for a Week program is working through 39 school systems now and introducing that farm.
Since you mentioned it, this is the program where the kids actually grow food in their schools.
Or they're actually there's some of that, and but it's also making sure that school nutrition officials can learn how to use the system to source local product for those markets for local producers there. But we've just launched a key vision for the future. It's our 2020 vision for school nutrition. And our vision is the start of school in 2020. We want to be that every school, every meal, every day in Georgia, that at least 20% of that menu is Georgia Grown, and that 20% of our schools are at 50%. So we're working with a wide population and a key dreamers and leaders all across the state to help make this possible. So whether it's in the consumer marketplace or at schools or at restaurants or, you know, the fresh product you might acquire from a farmer's market, we believe that this brand has a lot of power wherever it's used, and great members like Ross are really proving that.
So, Ross, there has been a lot of confusion from consumers on what all of these labels mean because of things like organic or all natural or local, even, that don't necessarily have a definition. So when you put the Georgia Grown sticker on, what are you communicating to your, I mean, literally you're communicating this was grown in Georgia, right?
Well, I think we're communicating to them that food, and it may be produce, but it may be a finished product, right? So this was grown or produced here.
Oh, right. If it's your the ginger, but in your case, that's both the product and the...
Well, it is. It is in our case, but not in every case, right? And it's just as important that you have food producers who are producing a finished product here in Georgia. I do think that what it's communicating to people from our side is provenance. It's location. It's, I understand it, that this is a product in a local part of a community that has a history of being a high-quality food producer. And so it's trusted. I think that's very important. It's not overhyped, you know, which I think words like, you know, natural, it's not something that a corporation is simply using as a marketing tool. It's trying to portray to end customers some information about the product that allows them to make a choice, an informed choice. And I assume for different people it might mean different things. But for most of them, it gives them a geographic grounding in where their food came from.
My guests are Agricultural Commissioner Gary Black and Verdant Kitchen CEO Ross Harding, and we're talking about a statewide initiative known as Georgia Grown. Is the Georgia Grown program played for entirely by those who participate, the farmers and the distributors? And
yes, it's the Georgia Grown Commodity Commission is that part of the program is supported by those who are the license holders, and so people have been familiar with agricultural groups promoting their own product, like with the Milk Commission and the old
the
milk,
raisins,
milk mustache.
The dancing raisins.
Yeah, that's all of that comes from producer-owned or producer-run commodity commissions. We decided to, since this is such a broad commission, that they actually renew annually with the license to use the brand. And that's how those monies are poured back into the department. We manage them in trust on their behalf. And then just continue to advance, you know, Georgia Grown marketing activities. We have had some, you know, our marketing division of the Department of Agriculture does have some support from the legislature and the governor, and we're very grateful for that. But the whole focus of the maintenance of the brand and some of our general Georgia Grown activities are supported through the Commodity Commission.
So, Ross, I want you to pretend that Gary's not in the room with us. What is the pros and cons of doing this kind of thing through a government agency as opposed to, say, the egg producers, like the Incredible Edible Egg, right? I mean, does getting the state involved help you or hurt you?
I really haven't seen it be a detriment at all. Whether Gary's here or not, I mean, I would be more than happy to tell you if we saw problems with it. We haven't. It's been well coordinated. It's very broad based, and so there's no partisanship in it. One of the great things about having it done through the Department of Agriculture is that they're representing a very broad range of agriculture and food producers. And so, you know, it's not as though egg producers, you know, are running the show, or beef producers, or tree growers. I mean, it's broadly based and very equitably distributed. So we haven't seen, you know, a downside in it. We're very happy to pay our dues, and we think we get fabulous value for money.
And the Incredible Edible Egg was actually a promotion of the Georgia Egg Commission of years ago.
So I still remember that jingle.
So I think maybe our activities of the past maybe have been successful because
growing up in California, I knew that jingle. Yeah.
And I would also say, Celeste, that, you know, we were, I guess, our only concern going into this was this something that was only going to play well in Georgia? You know, was the Department of Agriculture going to produce a program that limited our ability? I mean, we're not a Georgia-only business. We're a Georgia-based business, but we sell our product all across the U.S. and increasingly now, you know, overseas. So it has not hurt us. It's helped us, you know, and the Department of Agriculture haven't limited its appeal. It hasn't been, this is only something that plays well to companies in Georgia or to schools in Georgia. It plays just as well in California as it does because it's a known, trusted brand.
Gary Black is the Georgia Agriculture Commissioner, and Ross Harding is the co-founder and CEO of Verdant Kitchen. Gary and Ross, thank you both so much.
Thank you, Celeste.
Great morning. Thanks.
This is On Second Thought. There's no shortage of meal delivery services these days, but only one boasts fresh ingredients grown here in Georgia. Peach Dish is a monthly subscription service that delivers what you need to make Southern-inspired meals. And so we thought we'd try a Peach Dish meal for ourselves. Producer Taylor Gant and I placed an order, met in the GPB kitchen, and went to work creating beef tacos with red cabbage slaw, radish, and lime. I've never used a meal delivery service, although I will say that in New York, we have Fresh Direct, which is a grocery delivery service, and that is fabulous. I wish we had that here. But I've actually written letters to Fresh Direct saying, please come to Atlanta, and that is not a joke.
Any response? Like, hey, we're thinking about it?
Or? They said, we're so glad you enjoy the service so much. Sorry we don't serve your area.
Yeah.
Which I felt was just rubbing it in. So, you know, it looks like you just chop a cabbage the same way you chop an onion.
Long ways than short ways, basically?
Yeah. Basically. Mm.
Do you cry when you chop onions, Celeste?
You know where the crying comes from.
No, I don't.
Because these are cells are filled with juice, so you cut and it's actually hits your eyeballs.
It's actually onion cells?
Yeah, these are like they're mostly an onion is mostly water. It's the science of cooking, Taylor Gant.
What kind of beef are we working with today?
We don't know. It just says ground beef. White Oak Pastures, though, in Lufton, Georgia.
Oh, very good.
Okay, so time to make plates.
A little relish. Ooh la la, very good.
Get a little more on there. And we'll grab a little bit of this. Sprinkle, a little bit of lime. Definitely some cheese. Put that on there as well.
I need another bite.
Okay. Got to build up to it.
Well, that time I just got a great big huge hunk of cabbage. That's good.
Right.
I would take credit, but all I did was carry out the instructions, so I can't really. But it's good.
That's two thumbs up for those who can't see. Mmm. That tastes really good.
Right?
Well done, Miss Headley. Mmm.
Well done, Peach Dish. If you want to try Peach Dish for yourself, you can find menus and information at peachdish.com. Georgia has been synonymous with the peach for more than 100 years, but is this peach a Southern success because it's so delicious? Fuzz actually has more to do with it than you might think, says at least one Georgia professor, Thomas Oakey. He teaches history at Kennesaw State University, and he's written about the significance of peach skin and all that fine fuzz that comes with it. It's in his forthcoming book, The Georgia Peach, Culture, Agriculture, and Environment in the American South. And he joins me now. Hi, Tom.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Dan Horton. He's professor emeritus of entomology at the University of Georgia. So, Dan, you're going to tell us all about insects, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And Al Pearson is a fourth-generation peach farmer and co-owner of Pearson Farms. Al, it's good to have you as well.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
How many peaches, Al, do you farm and harvest every year?
We have about 1,500 acres of peaches that occupy us.
Do you have any idea what the number of peaches that translates to?
That would be about 500,000 times 60 years.
That's
so
a lot.
30 million, something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that's a lot of peaches, I'll say that. Okay, but let me go to you first, Tom, because this is your theory of kind of going with peach fuzz to talk about the importance of why the peach is so important to Georgia. So give me the elevator pitch. What's your theory here?
It's really just a way of thinking about one reason why the Georgia peach was successful. You had in the 19th century all these horticulturists who wanted to grow all kinds of fruits, gooseberries and citrus and pears and plums and grapes. And peaches were the one thing that kind of stuck. And I think part of the reason for that is the fuzz that does provide a little bit of resistance to the pests. Now, I'm no scientist. Dan Horton can talk.
That's why we've got
Dan
here.
More authority on on how insects like the fuzz, but I think it's an interesting way of thinking about the peach's environmental adaptation to the South.
And peaches are not originally native to Georgia. All of these things were brought in here to experiment.
That's right.
Right.
Well, peaches actually came over with Jesuit friars in the 16th century, so they've been here for quite a long time. They're practically native. They're from China originally.
Okay. So when you talk about the peach fuzz making a difference, why do you say that? Why? I mean, the difference between we've been saying it over and over, the difference between a peach and a nectarine is just that fuzz. So what was it about the fuzz that made that particularly attractive to Georgians?
Well, this is an environment with a lot of pests. It's humid. We don't have really harsh winters. So we have a lot of pests. I think the fact that peaches succeeded in the way that nectarines never have is in part because insects and pathogens can't get a grip on the peach in quite the same way that they can on nectarines or plums, say.
Haha, that brings us to you, Dan.
All right.
So tell me about the peach fuzz. And, I mean, is there an evolutionary benefit for the peach to have that fuzz?
Well, this is going to ramble off into theory rather than hard science.
I'll try and edit you.
Please do. Peach fuzz is like many other traits present in plants that will discourage an assortment of pests. If you think of it from the scale, say, of an insect, if you were a very small caterpillar trying to bore your way into a peach and the moth lays an egg on the fruit, then the little caterpillar, which is obviously tiny, has to negotiate through a very dense thicket of pubescence. That's quite difficult.
The pubescence is what scientists call fuzz.
Fuzz, hair.
Yeah.
And so I think that's been much more thoroughly studied in some other crops. There's no question about it. It's a physical barrier, but there's also certainly chemical defensive compounds present that make it just a little bit more difficult on an insect or perhaps a fungal spore simply because the fuzz vastly increases the surface area of the fruit.
I guess my completely unscientifically educated thought would be that it's harder to hold on to something that's smooth. But if you're that tiny, that's the opposite, right?
I think I would look at it that is very often you've got, for insects, it's something of an obstacle course, and especially when they're tiny, they infest fruit because there's lots of them, and the lucky ones survive. The other thing that I would observe, and I'm sure Al could comment on this, if you look at a single drop of dew, for instance, on a peach, it sits up there way up high, and I think it's basically nestled on top of all of the fuzz, which holds it away and allows a bit more of that moisture to evaporate.
Oh, that's really interesting. Well, then let's bring you into this conversation, Al. You, your farming goes back in generations in your family. Have you always focused on peaches?
Yes, since the late 1800s, my great-grandfather came in and began to buy land and plant peaches, and we hadn't had enough sense to get out of it. So I'm still in it.
What is it that you think makes the peach successful in the South, and especially in Georgia?
Well, it's hard for me to accept that something that is as irritating as fuzz is actually a benefit, but I know it is. I think the worst job I ever had to do was clean fuzz out from under the packing shed. When the process was automated of packing, we had dry brushes that just brushed the fuzz off the peach and blew it up under the packing shed. So then some lucky soul had to crawl up under there and get it out, and I was nominated and elected.
That was you?
That's a bad job.
That sounds like a bad job. Let me put this out to our listeners. Do you prefer a peach or a nectarine? Because we wonder how you feel about the peach fuzz. Irritating, like Al says, does it gross you out? Or, does it kind of feel like a freshly shaven head, kind of cool to touch? Give us your peachy first thoughts at OST Talk on Twitter. You can just call us. Let me bring this back to you, Tom, because you use the fuzz as a jumping off point for all kinds of things, and especially to talk about the environment. One of the things you point out that I find interesting is the fact that part of the reason peaches succeeded because they worked well in tandem with a cotton crop.
That's right.
How does that work?
So the peaches emerged most successfully in the South in the Cotton Belt. And part of that's environmental, but part of that's also, it's actually kind of a social fit as well as an environmental fit. So you can't just have a new crop that fits well with the environment. You also have to have a social system that supports it. In the Cotton Belt, which is not mechanized, you have a lot of people who are working in cotton. And it just so happens that the peach harvest happens at a moment when there's a real lull in the work. And at a moment right before the cotton harvest, which remember, if you're only getting paid once a year, you're probably feeling pretty desperate, right?
Yeah.
So at a moment when you're willing to take any work. Peach growers were paying cash in a lot of cases around the turn of the century, which doesn't happen a lot in the rural South. So it was a good job. And it fit perfectly with the cotton schedule.
And I wonder, Dan, as we move on to the relationship with the the wildlife, do you call insects wildlife, of Georgia. Do we actually have evidence that insects are less interested or less successful at nesting inside a peach?
Well, we have studied some of the primary insect pests of peaches. For instance, Plum curculio, which is a small native weevil, it's a pest. Its actual preference, more than anything else, is the Chickasaw plum. So it likes the native
I don't know.
Host better.
How is a Chickasaw plum different from a plum that I ate in California?
I would leave that either to Tom or perhaps Tom's dad to explain that. There's a lot of hybridization of different plum species to get to the species or to the plums
all
that you would be familiar with.
These ins and outs of fruit. But continue with what you're saying. I'll ask Tom in a second about the Chickasaw plum.
The Chickasaw plum is clearly this insect's favorite. It will sting or lay an egg in at least 90% of the fruit in a plum thicket before it will even wander into an adjacent unsprayed peach orchard. So there are big differences out there. However, one thing I will say about insects that have a fairly narrow host range, they do not starve.
Well,
and if we provide them with a bounty, which a monoculture is, then they will adapt and adapt very well. And there's clear evidence that there are other insects that, for instance, the lesser peach tree borer, which is a pest that attacks the tree, not the fruit.
Oh, I see.
Even though its native host are clearly wild plums, it likes the domestic peach, Prunus persica, much better.
And I'm sure Al doesn't like it at all. But let me bring this back to you, Tom. The reason that he's referencing you is because you did not follow your father into his chosen business. You're a history professor. Your dad was a famous peach breeder, correct?
That's right. Yep.
Which may be the source of your interest in peaches.
Yeah, I grew up in the middle of peach country, but from the kind of the research scientist side of things. So my dad bred peaches. I think about half of the peaches that are grown in the South now are his varieties.
Really?
They usually have the name Prince in them, July Prince, June Prince, Fire Prince.
Al, do you use any of Tom's dad's varieties?
I sure do. We are full of them, and it's been a good bit of work that his father did, and we are appreciative of it.
And Tom, I want to let you talk a little bit more about some of the other implications you've drawn from peach crops in Georgia especially, because you talk about what growing so many peaches and harvesting so many peaches here has done to the composition, the sociological composition in terms of labor of the state. What did you find?
Well, as I was saying, that you had early on, you had this kind of labor surplus at the time when you needed it in peach production in July and August. When cotton mechanized and as African Americans left the South and left the rural South,
this
especially.
This is post-cotton gin.
Well, cotton gin is early 19th century. This is post-World War II. We don't really mechanize cotton in the South until after World War II. So people are still hand-picking, doing a lot of hand work. So you have this manual labor force that's there. And peaches, I think, part of the reason they got their start so strong in the cotton belt is that they had that labor force that was available. As those workers left, it became more difficult for growers. And I think, Al, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think getting a reliable labor source is probably one of the biggest challenges for growers today, and was really from, say, the 1960s until the guest worker programs of the late 90s and early 2000s.
All right, we only have a couple seconds left, but I need all of you to tell me what your recommended recipe with peaches is. Al, let me begin with you. What's the best thing to make with peaches?
Pearson peach ice cream.
Okay. Tom?
No question.
Eat them fresh.
Eat them fresh. Yeah. And Dan, do you have a preferred way?
Yes, ma'am. My Aunt Eva's peach dessert, which is basically a cobbler.
A peach cobbler. Okay. All good suggestions. Tom Oakey is a professor of history at Kennesaw State University, author of the forthcoming book, The Georgia Peach, Culture, Agriculture, and Environment in the American South. We also heard from Al Pearson of Pearson Farms and Dan Horton, professor emeritus of entomology at UGA. Thanks to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
This is On Second Thought. So how do you know if a house is abandoned? Busted windows, obviously, overgrown lawns, slabs of wood used to barricade entrances. Sometimes the junk mail is stacked up in the mailbox. Some signs are not as easy to see, though, like just how much vacated homes cost a city. A recent study by Georgia Tech professor Dan Immergluck reveals that upkeep of blighted properties run up a tab in the millions of dollars for Atlanta. And then there are the bodies. Corpses have been discovered in vacant properties across the city, and that includes two women who were strangled to death and dumped in an empty home. Today we'll talk about blight with a panel of people who study this problem. Dan Immergluck of Georgia Tech joins us once again. He's a professor of city and regional planning at Georgia Tech. Hi, Dan.
Hi.
Willoughby Mariano, investigative reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Good to see you again, Willoughby.
It's great to see you.
And Tina Arnold is the executive director of the group Sustainable Lakewood. Hi, Tina.
Good morning.
Dan, how many abandoned homes do we have in the metro Atlanta area?
Oh, I don't know about the metro, but we certainly have tens of thousands. In the city of Atlanta, the city did a study a couple of years ago and identified 8,000 or so residential vacant properties. About 2,400 of those were in really distressed, dilapidated condition.
What does distressed condition mean? Is that a technical term?
Well, they basically classified in the survey properties that were in good condition, fair condition, and then poor or dilapidated condition. And they had a kind of visual inspection device where they looked at the condition of the house. And if it was boarded up, if it was seriously dilapidated physically, if it was really unlivable, it fell into the poorer dilapidated categories.
So, Willoughby, since the study that Dan is talking about, the city has taken some action. There's been some attention to abandoned properties. What's happened?
Well, so far, there's been a sort of a study committee on the issue. There's been more money devoted to code enforcement and a great deal of revitalization efforts in some of the most troubled areas, for instance, the English Avenue neighborhood near the stadium.
Since you mentioned that, let's hear from DeMarcus Peters. He's with the English Avenue Neighbors Association, and he's talking about a common example from his community.
It could be a property that was intended as an investment for someone who didn't necessarily live within the community but thought it was a good idea to make an investment, but then realized that that investment was way, they're in way over their heads. Meanwhile, whole blocks or parts of blocks become abandoned and what would serve as safe harbor for people who would do criminal activity.
Willoughby, how many of, do we have any idea how many of these homes are owned simply by absent investors, people who just bought up houses?
Well, Dan actually did a little bit of, well, a lot of work on that, but it's hard to tell because the names on these, on the companies that own these properties are sort of vague, and it's hard to figure
track
out
down.
who owns what. Individuals might own properties, and it's not clear if they are investors or, you know, from if you just look at the records, whether or not they plan to live there.
So, Tina, this brings us to you, because not knowing who owns a home is part of the reason that it's very difficult to address blighted houses, right?
Correct.
What have you been doing about some of the abandoned homes in the areas?
Well, we've been working for years now to help our own situation. If that means going in, cutting the grass, throwing mulch, we'll take truckloads of mulch and pour it on top of the grass so that we don't have to cut that grass again that year. We'll board the houses, and then we'll paint murals on the board. So it becomes a gem versus yet another problem for us to look at all day, every day.
Well, then, what is the, describe to me the problem of an abandoned home. How, when and how does it become a problem?
It becomes a problem the day the owner doesn't come and take care of it. You know, it's, you have investors that, as he said, they want to do the right thing. They want to buy a house. They want to restore. They want to get into the real estate market. So they come in and they start working on the house, and then it's not properly boarded, or they have some guy from the street that says, hey, I can paint your whole house for $100. They go for it, and then when they come back, everything's gone. They had no insurance. They don't have more money to restore the house. So that's one of the examples of how the properties turn into empty shell messes for the rest of us. So without money, they just leave it. They just, you know, one day I'll come back, I'll do something, I'll save again. But in the meantime, the windows are being broken out. Homeless people are moving in them. People that are actually ripping off the other houses are using those to store, you know, some of that, those materials. And so...
So, that wait, people go and burgle homes that are occupied, and then they store the stolen goods in these abandoned homes.
They burgle occupied homes. They burgle unoccupied homes as well. So they need a place to put those cabinets and countertops that just stole from the house next door, you know, so they'll store it in there, and then, you know, they'll come back and continually use it. And of course, both houses are now empty shells. Both houses are sitting vacant, you know, with the windows knocked out, but nobody's going in them, not the normal working class citizen. We're not going in those homes because they look scary to us. They look like those haunted houses that, you know, we saw as kids that scared us to death. So we're not going in those houses. You know, I have not been in any of those houses personally, except for unless an owner says, Tina, you can go in. And then, of course, we've got to make a lot of noise before we go in because you will find people running out the back door.
And here's what that brings us to the bodies that have been found in some of the homes, Willoughby. The two women that were found recently had both been killed? Has those been ruled homicides?
Yes. Yes, definitely homicides. And some of their bodies have been in there for a while. And the funny thing is that the sad thing is that these homes become places for mischief, like these neighborhoods do. People do things in these neighborhoods. They come from the outside and do things in these houses, in these neighborhoods that they wouldn't do near their own homes. And so you find people dumping bodies there. You find people who died there because they entered the abandoned house to shoot up heroin. You find people who were squatting who had health problems that were never addressed, and they die. That's the sad thing about these homes. They're sort of a consequence of neglect and people's perception that no one really cares about what happens in the community.
Which, of course, then becomes a public health issue, and also in the end is going to make it much more difficult to sell and rehabilitate that house. And then let's then bring in the cost to the city, which what kind of things did you include when you were estimating cost, Dan?
Well, we looked at two kinds of costs. First, we looked at what I call service costs, which are code enforcement costs, chasing down owners, going out to the building week after week. We also included police costs, 911 call costs to these vacant properties, fire costs. Some of these properties are involved in fires, and often vacant property fires are the most expensive fires because they're major fires. And we also looked, the other kind of costs we looked at are what I call spillover costs, basically the cost to the neighborhood that we can put a dollar figure on, which most directly is the decline in property values near those vacant homes. And when we added all these up, we basically got an annual figure, both including the service costs and the decline in property tax revenues, of between $5 and $6 million a year.
Holy cow. Now, I looked on, this was from, I think, 2013, but I looked on a list of the cities with the most abandoned properties, and Atlanta is among the top 10. And I wonder, Tina, how much interaction have you had as you're going around with Sustainable Lakewood trying to board up homes and dump mulch on lawns? How much interaction do you have with the city?
We have some interaction with the city. The city has helped us with dumpsters when we're doing neighborhood cleanups. So we can actually take and clean off these homes and put the trash in the dumpster, and it's hauled away most times immediately, so that you don't have a whole lot of extra spillover from everybody else coming and putting in. You know, we've encountered, you know, housing code enforcement and the police a few times, you know, where they're saying, who are you? Why are you on this property? And, you know, do you have permission? You know, things like that.
But, I mean, would you say, I mean, I assume that you think more needs to be done, although we're hearing from Dan that's very expensive.
I do.
Who do you hold accountable?
I hold everybody accountable. I mean, I think that just everyone is responsible. The city is responsible through its legislation, and the state through its legislation, or lack thereof, of being able to instantly be able to call a property owner. I hold the state accountable for the fact that, you know, people can go and purchase a property without any form of identification. So therefore, if you ever go to the city's interim and listen in, you'll find that there's a lot of people that are called in to the interim to get a ticket, and they find that they own a property in Atlanta they never knew anything about because someone else, some crook, put their name on a property. And so now the city has to take responsibility for those properties that these people never knew anything about. I mean, the Sheila E. Foundation had two houses in our neighborhood that Sheila E. Foundation knew nothing about. They'll title them in other people's names, and so they sit.
So Willoughby, a few years back on this very issue, you interviewed a guy named Rick Warren, who's an investor from Buckhead, and he bought up a big chunk of property on English Avenue. Here's a little bit of that interview from 2014.
I am not a nonprofit. To look at any single street in the community and say that I own the majority of everything on XYZ Street, you're looking at one street in a community that this community across the board has issues and challenges that need a lot more than just owning 20 or 30% of one street. That's not going to resolve the issues and the challenges of what you deal with on a daily basis.
You had an update to the Rick Warren story. What's that?
Yeah, he's been convicted. He was convicted in September and sentenced in October to jail. He's appealing that.
On what were the charges?
On code enforcement violations. He won't be doing hard time. But he now has the opportunity to spend 30 days in jail for each count. But he is appealing, so he hasn't spent any time in jail.
So, Dan, where does this leave us? Who in the end is responsible? I mean, we only have about a minute left, but who do we see as the person who sort of has to get to the table to solve this issue?
Well, there's lots to do. The first thing I'd say is we still need to prosecute people like Rick Warren, but that's a very long and costly process.
Yeah.
And we have really hundreds of irresponsible, if not thousands of irresponsible investors out there. We need to start taking the property. We need to move more quickly through what's called judicial in rem foreclosure to basically put liens on properties, sometimes knock them down, sometimes fix them up. These liens become, through this judicial in rem process, a senior lien that can be foreclosed on. The city can take the property, put it in the Atlanta Fulton County Land Bank, and clean it up and remediate these properties. That's starting to happen. It's happening quite slowly,
yeah.
And it needs to happen much more. The city also needs some money to do this.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And one issue is Macon has passed a $14 million bond last year, and they're starting to spend it. And it's used primarily for blight remediation. There's no reason the city of Atlanta couldn't do the same thing.
That is Dan Immergluck, professor of city and regional planning at Georgia Tech. We also spoke with Willoughby Mariano, investigative reporter for the AJC. And Tina Arnold is executive director of Sustainable Lakewood. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Before we go, a note about a recent segment on this show. Last week, we talked about the Church of Scientology's expansion into the state of Georgia. A new church opened last month in Metro Atlanta, and we spoke with local Scientologist Joseph Bell about what that means for him as a member. We also spoke with Tony Ortega. He is a longtime journalist who's researched and written about Scientology for years. But the information Ortega shared with our audience did not sit well with John Sugg. Sugg is a Scientologist and a writer for the magazine called Freedom. That's published by the Church of Scientology. Sugg made many claims that our coverage of his religion was unethical and inaccurate. He questioned our editorial decision to book Ortega, who Sugg says is a propagandist paid to bash Scientology in the media. Here is Ortega's response to that accusation. Quote, "My resume as a journalist is not in doubt. I was employee of the New Times chain of newsweeklies for 17 years, including editor-in-chief of The Village Voice. I left The Voice in 2012 to write a book about Scientology. I'm now executive editor at The Lip TV, an internet TV startup. As for the website that I maintain about Scientology, The Underground Bunker, it takes in a small amount of donations from readers with the use of PayPal, like so many other blogs." End quote. One statement of Ortega's made on the show can be called into question, though. He said this.
"My sources include top former executives who had access to enrollment documents. And they tell me that at its greatest height, around the year 1990, Scientology had about 100,000 people around the world. I just talked to an executive who left just 2 years ago who said that, and he also had access to enrollment documents. And he said that number is down now to less than 20,000 people around the world. It's a tiny organization."
But an economic study by Florida State University in 2014 found about 10,000 Scientology parishioners currently reside in the Tampa Bay area, and more than 9,000 others paid long-term visits to the church in that city in 2013. The FSU study survey also says, quote, "It is expected those current numbers will increase given the recent opening of the Flag Building, providing additional specialized religious training and counseling services on November 17th, 2013, end quote. John Sugg also took issue with Tony Ortega's statement that church membership is mostly white. "We're unable to refute or verify that claim without more demographic information, which is not currently available from the church." But church member Joseph Bell of Atlanta said this.
"Man, these are good times right now, because I was in Scientology back in the day when there was hardly nobody black. What I like to see now is that I'm not the only black person. There are a lot of black people that know about this."
If you have questions or critiques about something you hear on this show, you know how to get in touch with us, Twitter, Facebook, or just call us. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Hadley. Have a great day.